is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Sam Sanders, filling in for Shumita Basu. Today, why Hollywood is broken and how to fix it. All right, have you noticed that it's not a super exciting time for TV and movies at the moment? Nothing coming out this summer seems like it'll come even close to matching the Barbenheimer phenomenon of last year. Box office numbers are already way down for 2024. And on TV, most of the big streaming services are planning to release far fewer scripted TV series than in years past. Also, with the notable exception of Netflix, almost every streaming service is in the red. It's even worse behind the scenes. Hollywood is losing a lot of money right now, and losing jobs too. Employment in the industry remains about 20% lower than before the pandemic. Media companies are consolidating, and only a few conglomerates now control the entire TV and film industry. All this is happening a little over a year since two historic Hollywood strikes happened around the same time. Actors and writers refused to work until they got better deals. A lot of people hoped that those deals that were reached after those strikes, that they would make things better. But it still looks like Hollywood is in a mess that no one knows how to get out of. I do, though, know someone who I think could help.
I am a true believer in film and television. I'm a true believer in the artists that make great film and TV, and I want nothing more in my life than for there to be great film and television for me to enjoy and for everyone else to enjoy.
For years, I have been a big fan of Franklin Leonard.
There is great storytelling being done here and abroad, and for the first time ever, there is the potential for all of that to be available to us. The challenge we have is, how do we support the artists that are making it? How do we compensate them fairly? And how do we build an infrastructure that allows all of us to monetize it so we have a sustainable industry?
Franklin is the founder of The Blacklist. The Blacklist is this annual ranking of the most liked screenplays that haven't yet been turned into movies. Getting on this list changes people's careers. It changes their lives. Movies like Spotlight and Slumdog Millionaire and Argo and The King's Speech, they all made The Blacklist. And they all went on to win Oscars for Best Picture. Franklin is an unconventional thinker when it comes to Hollywood, and he insists that there's a better way to do things in this industry than the way things are done now. So I called up Franklin to talk about what's gone wrong in Hollywood and how to fix it.
Usually things reach a crisis point and then we look back and say, wait a minute, how do we end up here? Mm-hmm. And I think that the industry is in the middle of one of those points where things are bad without the consumer necessarily realizing just how bad it is. Mm-hmm. And we could all wake up one day soon, theoretically, and then everyone will say, wait, why are there no good movies? Why is there no good television? Look, a lot of these are sort of basic business problems, right?
Yeah.
There's increased competition for consumer leisure time, which means that there's sort of roughly flat consumer consumption of film and television, like overall.
So what you're saying is, like, if we only have X number of viewing hours every day,
yeah,
and now TV and movies have to compete with Instagram Reels and TikTok.
Video games. The coming AI revolution, right?
Yeah.
Like, we have 24 hours in a day. Eight of those are sleeping. Eight of those are work or school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it used to be that film and TV were a primary, if not dominant, way that American consumers would spend their leisure time.
Mm-hmm.
There's just more competition. The internet brought a lot of competition, and sort of handheld devices brought a ton of competition into the wheelhouse. So there's, like, roughly flat to downward turn in terms of total viewer hours,
right? Of TV and movies.
Of TV and movies. It's increasingly difficult to monetize those viewing hours because, A, there's increased competition for them, so there's downward pressure on the revenue that you can make from them. Add to that the fact a few sort of, you know, own goals in terms of how we monetize streaming and moved away from a theatrical distribution model for film. You're just not making as many dollars per person hour watching the content.
Well, yeah, there was an active choice several years ago for these streamers to say, okay, no more ads. It'll work. It didn't quite work.
Look, I think that everybody was chasing Netflix, right? Netflix came in and said, look, we're just going to give you everything you could possibly want for $8 a month, right? And their competitors said, well, damn, if we don't offer something similar or less, we're going to lose all of our customers to Netflix. The fact of the matter is, though, as we're now seeing with Netflix themselves, that $8 a month is not sustainable. You need ads. You need a higher a monthly fee. So now we're seeing this sort of race back to what everybody is jokingly calling a return to cable with these bundles of streaming services.
Bundles and ads.
And that's just a return to the previous way the business was monetizing itself. Yeah. And you hear talk a lot now about, like, how do we get brands involved? How do we get companies to sponsor television shows? And that's, you know, that's a throwback to Palmolive sponsoring a variety show in the early days of television.
Listen, soap operas were sponsored by soap.
Well, exactly.
That's why they're called soap operas.
And I think if you could get a soap company to sponsor a television show right now, people would take that money in a second.
So we've talked about just the problem getting eyeballs in front of TV and movies. That is one big crisis for Hollywood.
Eyeballs and then monetizing
it. Yeah. Another part of the crisis is on the inside, the creatives that make this stuff.
Yeah.
There is a system in which they get paid less for the work, and parts of the work that used to be paid for are not anymore. Can we explain that? I think some of it, people might not realize the way TV and movie writing worked 25 years ago, it's very different now. And the way you get paid for that work is very different now.
The way you get paid, right? You used to get paid for the time you spent in the writer's room. You used to get paid, you know, when the television show went on the air, every time it aired, you got a check.
Every time.
Residuals. The streaming model is more driven by a sort of, you know, you basically get paid everything you're going to get up front. And then every time it airs, every time it gets watched, you don't see a dime. And again, I'm not here to say that the original model is better, but I am here to say that what has replaced it is insufficient to sufficiently compensate people for the value that they are creating as part of a supply chain of making film and television. Mm-hmm. And so my thing, and you can see it from the writers that were on strike last year, writers contribute a significant amount more than they are compensated, just in terms of pure economic value. Mm-hmm. And why they were on the picket lines, I was, in my opinion, two things. One is to protect the floor that they can be compensated when they're contributing at all. Mm-hmm. And two, to fight for a recognition that, hey, without us, y'all don't have
anything. We literally make the
anything.
Words. We literally make the words.
No one can do their job until a writer has completed their job. And beyond that, you know, there are a lot of studies that reflect that good writing is the best business plan. If you have a great script, you can get a great cast, you can get a great director. Yep. If you have all of those things, you have a much better chance of financial success in film and television than you do without that. And so I just think more credit in pure dollar terms needs to be accrued to the writing community for the benefit of the business as a whole.
Yeah. Well, and what I found really interesting when I was reading into how things have changed for writers, the types of things writers used to get paid for, they're not getting paid for now. So it used to be these studios would pay you for a while to think and write a bunch of drafts and just work until they got to the one that was right.
Yeah.
And now increasingly these studios want to say, we're not going to give you money until you give us the script that's ready to go.
Yeah.
And so the brainstorming is no longer subsidized. And then there's also less money and patience for writers to do it together. The writer's room gets smaller. And a lot of times these studios just want one person to write it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And that was one of the things that the Guild was fighting for, is making sure that writers' rooms were protected. And it wasn't just a single writer writing everything. There's definitely been downward pressure on the size of writers' rooms in years. Again, because studios just don't want to spend as much money, ironically, for the thing that is most going to determine whether they make money.
Literally.
And yeah, I think the brainstorming thing is a particularly interesting one. You know, yeah, it used to be that you would get paid for a treatment step. Right? Like a step where you sort of map out, this is what the thing is going to be before you even write the first draft of the script. And increasingly, there's a pressure to, now you do the treatment for free, you do the outline for free, you come in and pitch us beat by beat what this movie is going to be, and then we'll cut you a check to start writing and we'll
if
pay
we
you
like
on the draft
it.
If it's good. I think that what's interesting is that, like, it's hard to imagine any other industry where people underinvest in research and development. And that's what that is.
Pharmaceutical pays for the research.
Exactly. Pharmaceuticals companies pay a significant percentage of their costs
on R&D.
In R&D, because they know that when the R&D discovers something truly valuable, you know, pharmaceuticals is a hit-driven business too. When they really nail something, there is billions of dollars to be had in success. And that is very similar in Hollywood, but there is a vast reduction in that R&D spend, which again, put aside the morals and ethics of it vis-a-vis treatment of artists. Let's talk about cold hard cash. If you want to make money, you need to invest in writers and making sure that there is a robust, diverse community of writers that can sustain careers even in the short term when they're not working, so that the next great idea that comes from one of them will be here in Los Angeles when they have that idea.
Yeah.
You know, look, there are limitations that exist in a capitalist system to solve some of these problems. But even within the basic structure of capitalism, there are opportunities to capture financial and cultural upside that current leadership in the industry has just failed to capture.
Yes.
And I think it's a product of, frankly, mismanagement. I think it can be done better. And I would like to see the people that have the power to make change, make that change so that they can make more money. And all of us can.
Yes. It's hearing you say that, I can think of this like clear and glaring example. We have known for years now, if not more than a decade or two, that the folks who go to the movies the most are Latino people.
I was going to say, I know exactly where you're
going.
They
over-index.
Yep.
They over-index, especially for horror and thrillers.
Exactly.
But they just go to the movies more.
Yep.
And yet. The number of films made, particularly and targeted to Latino audiences, is still a fraction of what it should be.
Yeah. And the industry is losing billions of dollars a year as a consequence of that.
Yeah.
You know, McKinsey and Company, not exactly social justice warriors
not
by
at
reputation.
All.
I should stipulate also my former employers 22 years ago did a study on, it was first the study on the effects of anti-Black bias in Hollywood. And that study came out, I believe, in 2021.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found was that the industry is losing $12 billion annually. Just because of anti-Black bias.
Yeah.
And then several years later, they followed it up with a study on anti-Latin bias, found that they were losing somewhere on order of 16 to 18 million or billion a year. And they just put out a study this year about Asian and Pacific Islander bias, and that was another 4 billion. So we're talking about 30 billion a year in lost revenue.
Yep.
Money on the table. Money left on the table.
Yep.
Just because of sort of anti-Black, Latin, and API bias. That doesn't count our failures on women. It doesn't count our failures on the LGBTQIA plus community. It doesn't count our failures on the disabled community.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of money to be made by just making good choices.
Yes.
And as an industry, we have frustratingly failed to do that.
Oh, yeah.
I also remember there was an article that Bob Iger was patting himself on the back saying, at Disney, we made Black Panther based on our gut that it could be made as a successful movie, not based on the numbers. And if you're governed by numbers, you know, that way lies folly. And I think that really frustrated me.
Because you can do both.
Well, not only that, if you look at the numbers, Black movies have always succeeded. Coming to America made hundreds of millions of dollars outside of the U.S. in the mid-1980s. Will Smith, Denzel Washington, Jamie Foxx.
Everything
Fox
Eddie Murphy has ever done.
They've been global superstars now for decades. And, you know, throughout my 21-year career in Hollywood, I have been told directly, Black movies don't sell abroad.
Mm-hmm.
There's no statistical backing for that claim whatsoever, any more than there's statistical backing for the claim that women-driven action movies don't work, which I've also heard for the last 21 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if people would go actually look at the numbers, what they would discover is that the most easiest way to predict this, the financial success of a movie is its budget and its marketing budget.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing to do with the race or gender of the people that are in the movie or made the movie. People around the world want good stories well told.
Yes.
Period. And if you do that and you support it with marketing, you should be able to beat the current market because they're making decisions based on conventional wisdom that is all convention and no wisdom.
Yes. Yes. I want us to tackle a big question that may not have one answer, but if anybody can give it one answer, it's you. We have laid out just how bad things are in Hollywood right now. What is the biggest reason why?
I think incentives are misaligned.
Tell me
more. If I had to be as succinct as possible, I think incentives are misaligned.
Okay.
I think that the people who make decisions about what gets made and what gets distributed are not compensated directly based on the success or failure of those things.
Oh.
And as a consequence, they make decisions based on proximity to power, long-term or short-term social relationship or social gains, their ability to cover or provide an explanation for a failure after the fact, rather than, you know, capturing the upside of a risky decision that may have seemed unusual to other people.
Mm-hmm.
I think that artists are not able to participate in as much of the upside of the value that they create, and therefore they make decisions about what projects to take, what stories to tell, what to pursue as a consequence of that. Again, if I had to do the most succinct answer.
Yeah. I want to just now pivot to like fixes.
Yeah.
And you can lay it out however you want to, but just to set it up, if you were put in charge of all of Hollywood tomorrow, I know that is a job that doesn't exist yet, but let's say it does.
Yeah.
Franklin Leonard is mayor of Hollywood, CEO of Hollywood, and your only assignment was to fix all the problems we just laid out. What would be the first thing you do? Where would you start?
I'd have everybody reapply for their jobs and make the case that they belong in them.
Okay. Follow up to that then.
Yeah.
Which part of the industry would lose the most jobs?
I think leadership at the top.
Look, okay.
I think that one of the things that we know for a fact in Hollywood, again, the McKinsey studies validate this, but really everywhere, is that diverse leadership results in better business outcomes. And there is not a great deal of diversity at the highest levels of this business. It's not because there's not talent that exists who's capable of doing the job. It's because they just, the people who are capable of doing the job haven't been hired yet. And so I would like to see more diverse teams at the senior most leadership committees of most of the major Hollywood companies that are responsible for the vast majority of the content that the industry creates, because I know that they will do more diverse hiring, and more diverse hiring results in better business outcomes and more diverse content, which is also how you end up with the more, the better business outcomes. So that would probably be a number one. I think that we as an industry, and this is really what the Blacklist is trying to do, need to establish an infrastructure that allows for the efficient and meritocratic discovery of talent at a global scale, right? Like, why are we only looking for talent amongst the people with whom we have social proximity? There should be an infrastructure where no matter who you are and where you are in the world, if you have a great screenplay, someone can vouch for that script.
Yes.
And, you know, we've sort of leveraged our reputation because of the annual list to be that third party. But what's fascinating is that for the entire history of Hollywood, that didn't exist. We were basically telling people, oh, you want to be a screenwriter? Two options. Apply to the Nickel Fellowship, the Academy Screenwriting Competition. If you place in the top 100 out of 7,000, someone may call you.
Wow.
Or just move to LA, get a job at Starbucks, network until someone pays attention to you. And again, that's bad for aspiring screenwriters. It's worse for Hollywood. Imagine if the NBA told basketball players, oh, you want to be an NBA basketball player? Move to Midtown Manhattan. There's a pickup game right outside our corporate offices. Keep playing. Someone will probably see you, and then we'll assign you to a team.
Yes.
That's basically what's happening.
Well, and like other sectors have already moved to fix this. I remember when I began as a journalist, the path was you are an unpaid intern until they start paying you. And finally, around like 2010, everyone was like, yo, that's kind of classist and racist.
Yeah.
Who can afford to work for free? Who can afford to move to DC or New York and work for free for 6 months until they get a minimum wage job?
Yeah. And the answer is the children of rich people or people that already work there.
Yeah.
And that's very much been the case in Hollywood.
Yeah.
I think that's also at the root of this whole Nepo baby debate. Like, no one has anything against people who have the benefit of access because their parents were successful in a
field. I think Maya Hawke is great.
Yeah, no, look, I could go down a long list of incredible people whose parents
Johnson,
also worked
great.
In the business.
Willow Smith, great.
The question is, if you are as talented as they are, do you have any chance of getting access?
Yes.
And until that's the case, we all lose.
Yeah.
No one wants to watch the NBA if every roster was just people that the owners personally knew.
Mm-hmm.
And on some level, that's what Hollywood has been.
Well, and the NBA, just to extend the example, the NBA has gotten so aggressive about saying wherever the talent is, we'll find it. They're shipping in players from all over the world.
Well, and that's usually the sort of button to my story. It's like the NBA got better when they started, you know, black people started playing.
Yes.
But now it's getting better because
they went global.
They went global. And if you look, and this is also part of what people are afraid of. If you look at the last couple of years, MVPs, they've all been non-American. They've been from Canada, they've been from Serbia, they've been from not here. Mm-hmm. Now, on one hand, if you are a sort of protectionist and you're like, oh, I only want Americans to be successful, that's bad for you. If you want to watch good basketball,
you're like, fine, go ahead.
You're like, this is a great era.
In the same way, I loved Squid Game.
Well, I was just going to, and
sorry,
Squid Game. No, we're on the same frequency. Yeah. No, Squid Game, Parasite.
Come on.
And there is more to come. And again, that's when I think about reasons for optimism. Mm-hmm. There is great storytelling being done here and abroad. And for the first time ever, there is the potential for all of that to be available to us. The challenge we have is, how do we support the artists that are making it? How do we compensate them fairly? And how do we build an infrastructure that allows all of us to monetize it so we have a sustainable industry?
Yeah. When I was reading up for this interview, something that kind of blew my mind is the history of government intervention in Hollywood.
Yeah.
For decades, the federal government closely regulated Hollywood. The Paramount Decrees of 1948 kept studios from being able to actually sell the content they made to prevent monopolies. In 1970, the FCC instituted the Financial Interest and Syndication Rules. It's called FinCEN. This kept film studios from owning TV networks and vice versa to increase competition. Basically, for decades, the government worked to keep companies in Hollywood from becoming too powerful.
Yeah.
And those rules have been rolled back over the last few decades. Could the government, taking a more active role in Hollywood right now, fix some of the problems we laid out? And if so, why is no one talking about that?
It's interesting. I think that, yes, there probably is a governmental role to be played, I think, as it applies to preserving a competitive marketplace.
Okay.
You know, I think that, you know, there are only a handful of major studios.
Like, four big companies kind of own most of Hollywood at this point.
And so you end up with an oligopolistic situation where there's a lot of sort of cartel spending. It's just, in an oligopolistic system, price setting gets weird, and you don't have a competitive marketplace that Adam Smith called for in A Wealth of Nations, right? Okay. Like, there's a market failure as a consequence of limited numbers of buyers.
Yeah.
I do think that there is probably some value in the government exploring regulating the marketplace so that it can be competitive and preventing companies from merging to make it less competitive. I will also admit, and maybe I've just been in this business too long, I have an instinctive anxiety about too much government oversight, particularly as it applies to culture, because I think second and third order effects can be really dangerous.
Yeah.
And I've watched people whose incentives are presumably aligned with the business try to make change and have a negative effect. And so I worry about a government intervention which is going to be misaligned, especially in a highly fractious government that we have right now. I worry that there could be inadvertent consequences that actually could make things worse. Mm. But I do think that it applies to oligopolies and anti-competitiveness. The government absolutely has a place to be involved. And that's probably going to be the place where it's more valuable, because a more purely competitive marketplace, the easier it will be to solve some of these problems, I suspect.
Yeah. Another fix that I will think of in the back of my head.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, can I say this out loud? I'm going to just tell you.
No, bring it on.
I want to say last fiscal year, the number of scripted TV shows across the whole matrix of Hollywood, it was approaching 600. And that's not even counting unscripted. So if we have literally hundreds of new shows to watch every year on multiple platforms, is one of the fixes not just to help figure out how to make these things make money, but also to make the experience better for viewers, is one of the fixes for Hollywood to, dare I say, make less stuff?
Well, you're going to get your wish regardless. the era of peak TV is over.
You can
rest assured that there will be less stuff made over the next couple of years. You know, it's interesting because I think fundamentally more television shows means a few things. It means more people are employed.
Mm-hmm.
It means that, you know, somewhere there's a writer who's writing on a show that may not be the best thing in the world, but they've got money coming in, which allows them to continue to write professionally.
Mm-hmm.
And they may end up writing something that might be incredible.
Yeah.
Right. And I also just think that, like, a lot of shows is a good thing. There's a lot of audiences. There's a lot of kinds of audiences. And you need a lot of shows to sort of sate everybody. Like, we don't need it's not necessary for everybody to be watching the same thing. And the things that are truly great become the thing that everybody watches. And then there'll be some things that are only watched by a few people and they get canceled after one season and those people are really mad, right? I'm okay with that, provided that the process of identifying which things get made and which artists get supported are as free of bias as humanly possible. Mm. And by the way, if they're as free as bias as humanly possible, they'll be dictated by what audiences actually want, and they'll probably make more money on balance than if they were dictated by the sort of whims of people who live west of the 405.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Another, you know, I thought I only had two.
Yeah.
I got another one where I'm like, is this actually the fix, and can I say it? Is this a private equity problem? Is this who's actually in charge of the money problem?
I don't know what the fix would be. I think there's definitely private equity complicates situations because the capital has certain demands.
Exactly.
Right?
And before you go there, I just want to underscore, today, the big three asset management firms hold the largest stakes in most big media and entertainment companies.
Yeah.
So finance guys kind of run these companies now. No longer the quote-unquote creatives running these companies.
Yeah, I think it's been a long time since the creatives have run these companies, period. But I think that it's different, right?
Okay.
If you run a major film studio,
yeah,
your plan is to continue to run a major film studio and for that film studio to exist for the next decades, hundreds of years.
Yes.
If you are a private equity investor into a film studio, your priority is to flip it and turn around a multiple on that investment as quickly as possible. So that usually means, you know, leaning down the organization and laying a lot of people off.
Making the product maybe worse.
Possibly making the product worse as long as
you can sell it later.
Exactly. And so, again, I think it's a matter of incentives. The incentives in this case between the private equity folks and the creatives and even the people that run the studio oftentimes radically differ. And that's where you run into really big problems. So I don't have a problem. Look, if private equity wants to invest in individual movies, great. You know, I think actually one of the really frustrating things about the last maybe 12 months, I think private equity investment in individual films was down dramatically last year. I think both because of the strike, but also because people were starting to invest more in like AI and things like that. But more capital in the space, good thing, right? Depending on what the demands and expectations of that capital are. How is that capital oriented? I think you can actually align incentives, whereas private equity is like, look, we want to invest in this movie, and our goal is to make as much money from this movie as possible. It's like, okay, well, that roughly aligns with what the people that are making the movie are doing. When private equity invests in a studio and says, we'd like to sell this for parts and fire as many people as possible,
that's not good.
That becomes long-term problematic for the industry as a whole. So again, I think it, for me, on some level, everything comes down to aligned incentives, and that's where I get anxious about private equity, but you know, do we need more capital in this business that goes to artists? Yes.
There you go. I want to ask a larger question about how we set this conversation, but I want to make sure, have we gotten to all of your list of solutions?
Yeah. I mean, I think the other big one I just think, and we talked about it a little bit, is just to recognize the value of writers in creating all of our scripted work. And I think that includes things like, you know, putting them in the spotlight a little bit. You know, we're all very much aware of the directors of things and the actors who star in things. And there's a culture of celebrity around those folks. And I think to the extent that we can embrace the people who authored the thing initially, I think we'd all be better off.
Yeah. One more thing I think about a lot as someone who makes audio for a living.
Yeah.
It's like you have to consistently, as a creative, as an industry leader, whatever, you have to think of your audience. When I began making audio, I was convinced that anytime my voice came on the air or in a podcast feed, every listener stopped and listened with concentration and maybe even took notes.
Oh, yeah.
In reality, people listen to podcasts while they're making dinner, driving the kids to soccer, in the gym, folding their laundry. And it is a honor and a privilege to even be in their ears while they're distracted.
That's right.
And I think a lot of Hollywood, particularly the part that was just leaning on prestige so heavily for a long time, they don't realize that after folks have had a long day at work or taking care of kids, they don't have the intellectual bandwidth to give your thing 110%. Can you make things that work for people who have busy lives? Can you make things for people who don't always want elegance? They just kind of want stuff that helps them decompress. Like, can you understand your audience enough to get over yourself?
The Japanese animator Hayao Miyazaki wrote a manifesto in the mid-80s that I've read translated because I don't speak Japanese. And he has this quote that has sort of been on my desk for the last 15 years now, almost 20 years now, actually. Yeah. And he's talking about, like, this is part of a passage where he's talking about audiences and movies.
Yeah.
And the quote, and I'll butcher it somewhat, is, you know, a popular movie should be full of true human emotion, even if it's base. The entrance should be low and wide so that everyone can be welcomed mm-hmm. in, but the exit should be high and purified. It shouldn't be anything that emphasizes or enlarges the lowness.
Yes.
And it's part of this passage that talks about the fact that as a filmmaker, you don't know what's going on in a person's life when they begin watching their thing. They could have just lost a child, their wife could have just asked for a divorce. They could have gotten a promotion that day, but you have no idea. And your job as a filmmaker is to make something that so arrests their attention, whatever mental space that they're in, that they only focus on your thing, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not that, like, oh, you need to make something that people can do the dishes to or whatever. It's make something that aspires to recognize that they might be doing the dishes
yes.
and makes them stop doing the dishes. And
yes.
you have to earn it. Right?
That part.
And ideally, you leave them when they leave the theater. And this is obviously talking about theatrical film, but I think it's true for everything. When they leave the theater, when they go back into their everyday lives, that work should be something that buoys them against the hardness of the
yes.
world.
Yeah. We have had this lovely conversation about how to fix everything in Hollywood. And I'm realizing we haven't talked too much about AI. Do we
yeah.
need to? I go back and forth.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm like, all right, we're making this thing a bigger boogeyman than it should be, but I wonder your take.
AI, like any technological advancement, is going to have, you know, a massive effect on the labor market. Some people are going to lose their jobs. There are other jobs that will be created. You know, I think the phrase that I've heard most often is, you know, you're not going to lose your job to AI. You're going to lose your job to a person using AI, which strikes me as right.
Mm.
I worry more about AI in the context of Hollywood and film and television in that it will create more competitiveness for consumers' leisure time.
Mm-hmm.
So in the same way that, like, the advent of video games, the advent of the internet, which I sort of view as like bi-directional or omnidirectional entertainment experiences, as opposed to film and television, which is me watching something and being told a story,
mm-hmm.
I worry that AI is going to result in an explosion of the sort of bi-directional and omnidirectional sort of uses of our leisure time,
mm-hmm.
which will mean more downward pressure on revenue for Hollywood. I also worry about the deployment of AI into the film and television making process in ways that are irresponsible.
Yeah.
I believe that technology should be the tools of artists, not a replacement for artists. And so I think that to the extent that guardrails can be set up around that, we should set those guardrails. But I also think that we don't know how AI is going to develop
yeah.
in the next 6 months, 12 months,
yeah.
36 months. And so we have to be vigilant. But again, I have a great deal of faith in, you know, fundamentally, art and storytelling is about the communication to human beings about what it means to be human. And I don't know that an AI can replicate the best of that. The sort of mediocre of that?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. I'm sure it will be able to make a mediocre horror
yeah.
film, let's say,
yeah.
in the coming years. But I think what that should mean is all the levels go up because
there
there's just more competition
yes.
and more, you know, mediocre stuff and therefore more good stuff.
Yeah.
But it's hard to predict because even the people that are making it don't really fully understand where they're headed.
Mm-hmm. How hopeful are you that these solutions you've suggested beautifully in this chat actually happen?
I'm not hopeful
okay.
about
okay.
those changes happening.
Okay. What are you hopeful about then?
I'm hopeful about the ingenuity of artists. I'm really hopeful about the fact that there are smarter people than me, smarter people than the people that are currently running the industry, that develop new business models, that tell brilliant stories, that figure out how to distribute their own content globally and monetize it and sustain careers that way. My hope is a practice, and it's also built on a fundamental belief that there are people smarter and better than me who will be able to fulfill these hopes that I have.
I like that. I like that. Last little question for you.
Yeah.
People that have made it through this conversation and are like, I like the way this guy thinks.
Yeah.
Recommend a movie for them that they maybe haven't watched yet.
This is hard.
I know.
I think if I had to recommend one recent film that I think got overlooked, and I don't totally understand why, except for the fact that, like, life is hard and the movie is very emotional. So there's a warning, bring tissues. But Ava DuVernay's Origin last year wrecked me. And I think it's a rare kind of film. you know, she had to seek financing from outside of the system. But it really is an attempt by a virtuoso filmmaker to present a unified field theory on human existence. And, you know, there's an inherent folly in that level of ambition. Mm-hmm. And there are, I think, reasonable quibbles for people to make about the movie. But I challenge anybody to leave that movie and not say, God, I wish more filmmakers were going that big.
Yes, totally. So, well, and what I love,
if I had to choose one, that would probably be it.
Yeah, but, I like that.
You know, also, like, life is hard, man. So just find a comedy that you love.
There you go.
There's no shame in that,
yes,
either. Like, it doesn't have to be an Oscar-winning film. Find what makes you happy, whatever that is. Celebrate it. If you see something great, say something, and, like, try to learn the names of the people who made it and celebrate them as well.
That's where we'll end it. If you like something, try to learn the names of the people who made it and celebrate them as well.
IMDb
Beautiful.
Is right there.
Yes. Yes. Franklin Leonard, thank you so much. I love this masterclass.
It's been an honor. Thank you, Sam.
Franklin Leonard is the founder of The Blacklist. And if you want to check out his movie recommendation, you can watch Origin on Apple TV. We'll include a link to it on our show notes page.